Okay, well, I am not going to talk about any of that. It's a topic for another day, and it's an interesting topic in itself. But so today is something else that I'm pretty passionate about, which is infrastructure. And I will firstly get the technology right so you can see what I'm looking at. And really just what I want to do is introduce coffee very briefly for those who don't know much about us. I want to sort of talk about where we're at as an industry in terms of delivering infrastructure. Talk about a few options, and that includes historical, where did we come from, where are we, what's possible in the future. How do those different models of delivery compare to each other? I want to talk about alliances, because I'm fairly passionate about alliance contracts and their potential to create value for everybody. A little bit of a case study, and also I'll just sort of wrap it up. So that's sort of the plan for today. Coffee Overview, a specialist consulting firm in physical and social infrastructure. So when we listed in 1990, or more particularly when I took over 13 years ago to the month, don't ask me the day, we needed a plan and we needed to differentiate. We came as a specialist consulting engineer. We were in the geotechnical space, and this is nearly our 50th anniversary. So we went around as geotechnical engineers, and most people who know coffee think of us in that space still. We wanted to differentiate ourselves from the other big engineering firms, so we decided to stay specialist and then just expand geographically and also expand the specialist services that we offered. So we're quite differentiated in a business sense. Most big engineering firms are one-stop shops. And what we've done is build a series of specialist businesses that now would, I would say, go from concept of project to completion of project. And they're not all the same size, so the concept of actually sitting up strategically advising clients about how to deliver infrastructure is part of what we do. Our more active work is in the delivery end of actually on the ground building things. But we really have moved up the food chain, and that's been a deliberate strategy to actually get up where you can add value to clients, as opposed to the days when I started, we were on a drill rig writing reports for something that we never saw happen. So we've come a long way in terms of getting close to the value add for not only ourselves, of course, but for our clients and ultimately society. We have grown. We're part of the ASX 300, which, you know, is a lot of fun. 4,000 people, it's also a lot of fun. And operations in more than 80 countries, of which I haven't been to less than half of those. So it is an organisation. If you're not comfortable with delegation and being out of control, you don't want to be running this organisation. It does require building a lot of trust and, as I say, having great people who specialise in what they do. So we have been delivering infrastructure in Australia for 50 years, though, and going right back to when David Coffey started the business. That's what we've been doing. So we look a bit like this on our webpage. You know, to re-emphasise our specialist capabilities, we've put our branding very much around those capabilities. And we still have a few brands in transition from acquisitions that we've undertaken, of which there are over 30 in the last 7 or 8 years. So that's kind of how we look. Let me talk about where we're at as an industry. I called it the challenges. So I guess in the last 10 years or so, we've been through boom times, and governments have been constrained in what they could deliver by the lack of supply from the engineering sector. And, you know, we've heard all the talk about needing more engineers and, you know, the lack of engineers coming through school, all that sort of stuff. And so there's been a big push towards that happening. During that time, also, government's seen how inefficient the infrastructure of Australia can be under the demand that was created. So, you know, we had blockages at ports, we had blockages everywhere. We look at our own road system and we can see blockages regularly. So the whole inefficiency of our transportation systems have been obvious. Different states have done variably good or bad jobs in fixing those blockages and easing those blockages, but there's no doubt there is still a huge backlog of infrastructure projects needed to really see Australia realise its possibility as an economic powerhouse. And you know, out of the GFC, we will see a return of demand. It's only a question of when, it's not whether it will occur. So there's a great opportunity right now for government to really get stuck into this backlog. In combination with the fact that The resources sector is obviously in downturn. That releases a whole lot of construction resources to actually come back to the engineering sector to actually deliver. So all we need is really to make sure those stimulus packages happen quickly, they actually turn into reality and not talk, and that we start to deliver on the backlog. And I think also, going back to this global sort of thing, that Australia still has a huge capacity to export this knowledge. If you look around the world at what other countries do, countries supposedly more sophisticated than Australia, perhaps that means they've been around longer, their delivery models are archaic by our standards. And you know, some of the things I'll talk about in terms of where we've got to, by comparison to, you know, when I talk about this, I was in the States talking to some people there, they just look at me, you know, just blank as if to say that will never happen in the US. There's no way we would ever approach things to have the trust between owner and deliverers to even contemplate that sort of delivery model. Well, you know, if they actually stepped back and said, well, where's the value equation, and actually forgot about what is and thought about what could be, there's a huge opportunity for our experience to actually be exported into those markets. And I know we're just a little country in the scheme of things, but like always, we can punch above our weight big time. And that's really, I suppose, what coffee is about, a small company going global and really punching above our weight. The other thing is, how can we tap into private investment in the absence of risk capital? I mean, again, GFC has created a situation where capital is dried up. It's moving out of Australia, and certainly the appetite for risk in infrastructure, and you know, the front page news like Bruce Connections really brings it home that anyone with capital is not going to take risk around some of those things that we've seen happen in the last 10 years. So, you know, if the government's not going to foot the bill, then how will we generate private capital to actually help build this infrastructure? Historically, you know, if we go back over my 30 years, things like construct only, a little bit rare these days, still exist, I suppose, in the building industry to some extent, but that's really the way things used to get done. We actually had public organisations actually designing and building things. If we go back, it's not that long ago, you know, when VicRoads used to design its own work and build its own work. And the construction industry was there when they were too overworked. So, you know, we quickly moved from that to design and construct. Alliances have come into favour in the last 10 years. PPPs exist, and I guess that's been the private risk equity model. And I guess I'd like to talk a little bit about what's an alternative PPP going forward. I won't go through in these great detail because these aren't really the point of it, but really just as a construct-only contract, it really is quite challenging if you think about the fact that a lot of owners have lost their capability in an engineering sense. They've downsized, they've outsourced, and really they don't have the capacity to actually really even brief a designer or certainly manage a designer. And if you're going to go to construct-only, you obviously need to have well-established design specifications and capability to manage. So it really has places in areas where there's, you know, simple design, commodity design, roll out lots of designs and get people to bid. They've always been fraught with conflict, so I guess no better than Baker's here to sort of be evidence of the amount of conflict that occurs in the construction industry. Read any other lawyer in town. It's been 30 years, you know, expert witness. So, you know, it's really great that we've moved a long way from that, although they obviously still exist, those disputes. But the owner also carries a lot of the operating risk. You know, it's fine to get through construction, but then, you know, what have you actually built and bought and have to manage thereafter? So it kind of works well for a knowledgeable owner on simple projects, would be my summary. If we talk about design and construct, this is, for me, where I could really start to see a shift of what COFI was able to do on major infrastructure projects. And it goes back to about 89 when I think VicRoads did their first D&C work on the Western Ring Road. And we started working with constructors actively to generate value and innovation and to challenge the way things had been done in the past. We created great teams with constructors, but we still had this other entity called the client sitting on the other side of a thing called a contract. And it was still fraught with disputes, and I guess there's also been significant disputes between designers and constructors. So really what we spend a lot of time doing is managing adversarial boundaries, and we spend a lot of time in court when those disputes aren't easily resolved. There's a lot to do with the fact that the cheapest price usually wins, and of course the cheapest price usually has a whole lot of assumptions which then end up in disputes. So, you know, it's an interesting evolution and it certainly created value, but I still think that there are still flaws in that system and we still see disputes occurring because of it. And I must admit these days I shake my head and think there are better ways, why are we still doing these sort of things? And I guess there's good reasons for it because, again, you know, you can only do more complex deals on projects that justify it. And I also find that, and having worked around various states of Australia, that there's a very much a mentality of what we say is best, and every state believes that, and every authority believes that, and, you know, there is no real respect or not a lot of respect between states for you know, they might get together and have national conferences and all talk about it, but at the end of the day, there is no national standards that we've really got as a country. And I've found it interesting that by moving from state to state under an alliance model, that people have actually been open to listening to what's actually best practice in other states. So, you know, I've seen, you know, the possibility now that we can actually innovate and create way better outcomes than sticking to our own sort of traditional models. But, you know, it also has, I guess in New South Wales particularly and Western Australia to some extent, gone from just a construct-only model to a DCM where maintenance has been put back to the consortium building it. And I think, you know, until the time when states moved on, and they thought those models were fantastic because they were not only transferring the construction risk but also the operating risk in those first few years of critical operations. So I think that's where we've sort of come from, and as I say, there's still a lot of activity, and design and construct in principle still exists, and it's really about how do you then contract it in a better way. Alliance contracts for me started about 2000, I guess, when one of my good construction relationships had come up to Queensland, we're going to do an alliance, and then explained what it was. So it sounded like a whole great way to work, where we would actually become a trusted consortium, and trusted being that the constructor, the designer and the owner would all become a virtual organisation and live and die by its own success without adversarial boundaries. And when people say what's an alliance, the simplest answer for me is that the contract says you won't sue each other. And, you know, lawyers kind of really glaze over at that point. And I can tell you the guy in the US that I was talking to who represents the professional services in the US as an industry organisation, he was just completely dumbfounded, you know, like, because I said, look, it's all about just contracting on trust. And I've used that term around the federal government sort of area as well in trying to create sort of more alliance type activity in the federal scene. And I said, why don't we just contract on trust? And of course, there's a whole bunch of lawyers who can tell you why you shouldn't do that, but all I can talk about is the success of having done that. And I guess, you know, that's all I'll talk about is what I can say has happened. The thing about alliances, it's principles driven. It's not a price driven selection. It's about the best team. It's about the principle of all winning together or all losing together. There is no win-loss situation where, you know, one party wins, the other party loses, which is traditional in any dispute. The owner only needs to know the fundamental objectives of the project. He doesn't need to be able to specify in detail what it is. It really is, I need to build a road from A to B and it's got to be about this sort of volume and so forth, but the detailed, more detail than that is not necessary. The alliance can potentially share and manage pretty much any risks that the owner wants to put into it. You know, that varies from owners as to how much they want to actually put to a project team, but certainly it's a lot more than a conventional D&C can manage because it's very hard to specify what community outcomes you want, and it's very hard to specify what environmental standards you want to deliver. But when you actually build a team and start designing and developing the project together, you can actually understand all that and integrate with those stakeholders and actually build it into the project delivery model. The owner seeks innovation and allows freedom for the team to create best for project outcomes. And this is what I found pretty interesting, that states were prepared to put their normal traditional specifications that they've been using religiously for 20 or 30 or 40 or maybe 50 years to one side to actually listen to what other best practice might be from other states. And that has created huge innovation and huge savings on projects. And if only those departments would take those learnings to the rest of their projects in those states, the saving to the community would be massive. I still haven't yet seen that happen. There's still a reluctance outside of the Alliance team for the, you know, for the organisations to really embrace that change. There's still an us and them mentality. So there's still plenty of scope to actually create much greater value inside the whole community, the whole industry. The projects are governed by a board with an Alliance Partners represented. So, you know, you might have six people on a board, each one having an equal say and decisions only being made with a unanimous decision. So ultimately the client gets to veto anything that the commercial partners might try to push. But equally, as having sat on those boards for about seven or eight projects, I get to equally veto anything that the other parties want to do. And as I say, if you think about, well, where I started, sitting on drill rigs drilling holes, to actually being able to decide how an infrastructure project was delivered, it's a pretty interesting model to actually put on the table. And it's interesting when you've got a forced sort of conversation to have about, well, why do you think that? If you've got a view, five out of six people have a view that one thing's right and one person has a view that it's not. It forces a conversation to find out what's missing for the other five people or why the one person's wrong. And it's a very, very different way of getting to outcomes. You know, I've just found it incredibly valuable to sort of be in that and actually to force ourselves to have those conversations, because, you know what, they're way cheaper to have those conversations, even if they take half a day, than to end up in court for 5 years resolving disputes. And that's kind of ultimately what it is, that, you know, when you're not forced to have them in projects, you tend to push on and get your own way until you don't, and then you end up in dispute. So it's very different in many ways, but it obviously embraces the whole design and construct and value creation by designers and constructors working together. But it introduces that really important part that the owner actually gets to contribute as part of that and really get their needs on the table. And not at one point in time being the time they specify the job, they can actually continuously upgrade and innovate throughout the project as they learn more about the challenges and risks that exist. And that's the real benefit, I think, for owners, is this flexibility to keep thinking, changing, modifying without the threat of variations, claims and disputes arising. And the efficiency around that, if you think about it, is God knows how many people, how many hours are spent on a traditional adversarial contract managing that boundary. All of that time goes into creating better outcomes for projects than in managing the interface. And just on a pure numbers of people not wasting time and adding value, it's just like a no-brainer that you're going to get a better, more efficient outcome. PPPs. It's interesting, I find it interesting that people talk about PPPs and Alliance as if they're the same, and yet to me they are diametrically opposed. PPPs were really about government saying, well, we need some equity from some players, and guess what, there's been a whole lot of them willing to raise capital, step in, take a decent fee for the privilege, and then take control of the project, and then try and shed as much risk as they can to those who are prepared to take it. So again, we've seen some pretty significant failures. Now, I know I've said this to Ken before, but, you know, CityLink for me was kind of a failure. From a government perspective, it was a great success, because government managed to shed risk to those who were prepared to take it. But if we look at the outcome of that, is that, you know, we had a project that ended up having delays because of technical issues. We ended up with a constructor that was sort of no longer around as a constructor. And as an industry, I find that disappointing, that, you know, that was the outcome. Great project, fantastic, you know, in every sense of the word. But, you know, ultimately, as an industry, I feel disappointed that, A, that we had the problems that we had, and B, that we've got constructors that have sort of really, and other people have borne a lot of the cost of that. Southern Cross Station was the other obvious one that became very public in Melbourne. And again, you sort of look and say, well, you know, you can say, well, why did people take those risks? But at the end of the day, it's just not good industry practice that we sort of shed risks And even if people think they've got it managed and they don't end up, you know, it's just not good for the industry, and it's very inefficient. So I sort of get concerned about, the thing that concerns me most about PPPs was the fact that, you know, we were getting state government people who understand delivery of infrastructure to suddenly start trusting constructors and designers, and hence alliances were really creating great value. Then suddenly we put bankers in place of state governments, and bankers were all about shedding risk and maximising returns for themselves, which is their job. So I kind of respect that, but I just don't think it was... I just can't work out what the point of it is other than to have the capital there. And now we've seen that the risks that have been taken around that capital are coming back to bite. So, you know, again, is that good for industry? You know, I mean, from a government point of view, I can say, well, you know, look, they're big boys, they took the risk. But again, it's just not... It's not the right way for me to actually deliver the best outcomes for the community. Someone's got to pay for that eventually. So I think that's where it's been. I mentioned M1 here because I think that's an interesting... I kind of called it a PPP, but, you know, really it's Transurban, VicRoads and the industry delivering the upgrade of M1. It's a massive job and we all live with it regularly, I guess, driving through it. And Transurban have obviously put up a fair bit of money to do that. So in, technically, I call it a PPP. I don't know what others call it, but, you know, they've actually put up certain significant amount of equity and the government's put up their own. And they are being delivered by alliances. So it's a different model because the private equity partner is actually a very knowledgeable partner. They actually know what they want. They're already running the road, so they're very clear on what they want from it. So they're not just a traditional financier in the sense of banks being a PPP partner. And I think that model's got some great opportunities for success because it is a combination of private equity and alliance contract delivery. And in a road like M1, you know, building that under traffic is hugely complex and really, in a traditional contractual sense, I can only say God help us if it was being done in an adversarial manner. So just as an alternative, if we look at where we are today and accept that risk capital is not going to generally be available to support, you know, the plans for the infrastructure rollout, and I suppose having been exposed through being a public company to superannuation funds, I can ask the question, well, guys, I mean, are you interested in investing in infrastructure? And if so, what sort of rate of return would you guys be looking for? So the words like 8% keep coming back. Yes, and yes, look, 8% would be good. 8% obviously isn't a risk price. So how do we tap into the amount of cash that Australia generates into its superannuation funds that is probably sitting there right now heavily in cash and not invested in equity to some extent? You know, up until a couple of years ago, was looking for a home kind of almost anywhere because, you know, the growth in equity prices was such that anything you touched was good. But now that's a whole new world. So where are people going to put their cash and get good rates of returns? So I sort of asked a few people, and I said, well, that looks like government bonds under any other language. So I guess I'd forgotten about those things. But, you know, 20 years ago, infrastructure bonds were good. And I sort of say, well, is that what we're going to do? Is that what government's embracing? And are there other models around that accessing that private capital without exposing it to the risks that we've seen with the other model of PPP? So I think it's really about thinking about, you know, what are the principles that we're trying to deliver. I mean, if we're talking about a partnership between private equity and government and industry, what else could we sort of put together in terms of a future that's better than the past, that does have some things like win-win, you know, that we don't see these win-losses that we can observe in the sort of things that I've talked about. And I use those only examples because clearly there are a lot of successes as well. So, you know, I'm trying to pick out where the things fail to say, well, how could we do it better? Could we bring the right type of capital provider into an alliance? I mean, that's not been done before, and not many alliances have really taken on the operating risk, but there's no fundamental reason why that couldn't be. So I think I throw those out as the opportunities that exist for us now, and again, as a non-technical person in the financial world, but as a practitioner in the delivery, I just say, ask the question, well, why not? And then, you know, I think we've just got to keep having that conversation as an industry to find a few options to consider. And I think interestingly was the Frankston Freeway announcement, where the state says, well, we're no longer going to ask you to invest in the traffic volumes because that's clearly high risk. So what about if we just ask you to make sure that the road that you build is available for use, and then we'll pay you on availability? So that's a completely different risk model to the idea that you then need to sit down and work out over the next 30 years how much traffic's going to flow down there and pay you an amount of money to actually use it. So I think those sorts of shifts in the risk profile and the will be interesting to see how the market responds to that sort of opportunity from an investment point of view. And fundamentally, this whole thing is about risk allocation, risk management, and risk sharing. And I like the idea that you actually share and manage risk, but you don't try and shed it, because someone ultimately pays for that shedding of risk. If I could just talk briefly about alliances, just to give you some more detailed information. If you look at those stats, you can see that the clear sectors that have embraced it are road and water. The states that have embraced it are Queensland, which is certainly where it started first, but you can see WA has moved on, New South Wales have moved on, and certainly Victoria is catching up. So it is being embraced by the state authorities. If you then look at alliance by cost in millions, you can see that the large proportion are somewhere in the sort of sub-billion dollars, and typically sort of 50 to, say, you know, 500 million. So anything less than that, my view is it's certainly probably too expensive to set one up to actually run a sub-$50 million project. And I guess no one's been too brave to get into the billion-dollar stuff, although M1's certainly up there as a significant amount of money. So you can also see on the right there that the number of alliances have continued to grow progressively over the years as they become, I guess, more and more and more successful. Personal experience, well, things like Inner Northern Busway in Brisbane, building a tunnel project under the CBD of Brisbane through a car park in front of the City Council chambers. I mean, let's do that one under an adversarial contract when we don't really know exactly at what level or at what alignment we want the road to go. And again, it just it delivered a fantastic outcome. You know, you've got to manage shop holders, you've got to manage shoppers, you've got to manage traffic, and that's where alliances actually excel, because they can take on all those things and deal with the changes that exist on almost a weekly basis. Very, very hard to specify up front exactly how to deliver a project like that. And I think the key that I'd emphasise is that I've worked on 7 or 8 of these, and on every one of them, the client, the constructor, the designers have all come out going, great project. Absolutely fabulous commercially, technically. Our people loved it. There were no disputes. I mean, it's one of the classic things is no disputes. You come at the end of the project, it's done and dusted, and it's finished. And, you know, in contrast to having these long-running litigations for several years afterwards. And, yeah, just clients speak for themselves as far as I'm concerned, you know. And a lot of the guys we've worked for, it's their first time doing an alliance, so they were very fearful. You know, as public servants under scrutiny, you know, they were always very scared about the whole thing not working. And at the end of that, they've always said, well, let's do the next one in the same manner. And most authorities have continued, and hence you can see that rise in numbers of alliances occurring around Australia. And VicRoads is an example for me, because I was working in New South Wales and Queensland. I said to VicRoads, guys, you've got to keep this on your list of possibilities, and they almost excluded it. I was sitting in some forums with them, and they almost took it out. They had some words that were really paying lip service to the possibility of doing alliance, and just no commitment whatsoever. And once they did the first one, you know, now, again, they're a convert and they're delivering quite a few projects using that method. Some of the benefits, flexibility to meet clients' need, I've mentioned that. Lawrence Hargrave Drive, that photo at the top, you've perhaps seen that in lots of car commercials, maybe not recognised it, but this state government of New South Wales had to shut the road because of rock falls. And this is a road that connected two local communities in a 5-minute drive, and forced the local communities to take a half hour drive up over the hill and down the other side to get the kids to school and back each day, just north of Wollongong. And they just shut the road and said, you know, after a rock fell down, nearly killed someone, they said, no more, we're going to fix it. But they had no idea what to do. So they just came to the market and said, we've got this bit of road and we want it fixed. So that's as much as they could describe, and then the teams basically came up with. In our team, we had 70 options that we considered in terms of how to solve that problem, and finally built this bridge out over the water, which obviously aesthetically became a wonderful piece of road infrastructure. And I did say to them in commercial terms, guys, we should sell the rights to advertising on this project because we'll all probably come out of this commercially better. And they said, no, we don't do that. Now every time I see an ad, I'm going, there's another few bucks we could have actually, there's another few bucks we could have had. So it's a wonderful bit of road. More risk than D&C. Certainly things, you know, we've taken on some pretty big risks. And the next one down the bottom there was Port of Brisbane Seawall. Port of Brisbane, the green port, absolutely petrified about killing the seagrass in Moreton Bay. Took them many years to get the environmental approval to build this, and they were paranoid that when we built out this rock wall out into Moreton Bay, which if you fly into Brisbane you will have seen, maybe not recognise what the devil it was, but we just built 4.5 kilometres of rock out into the water to actually then encompass what will be the reclamation of the future Port of Brisbane. But, you know, what they were fearful of was that these rock walls would fail and spread mud over the seagrass, which would have been an environmental disaster. So we delivered that. We actually delivered all the rock by train, as opposed to running trucks. You know, it would have been lots of trucks through the roads of Brisbane, through the residential areas. We actually built a train line to deliver the rock to this project. We brought it in well under budget and then actually built an environmental sanctuary type thing, as part of the funds we had, you know, which again sort of really enhanced the whole environmental stake. So things that, again, you'd never specify inside a project. So it's something that these are the things that are possible under an alliance model. Challenges for alliancing. 10 years down the track, I guess, where's it at? There's been constant concerns from Treasury that there's no price competition, therefore how can it be truly value for money? I just say, Treasury, come on board and be part of it, because then you'll realise why it is value for money. You can sit in, you know, away from the project and have that conversation, but if cheapest price is value for money, they're clearly not counting the cost of disputes and resolution of disputes. Price competition in alliances is a really bad way to start. We've been involved in one where we actually had to put a price on the table. What we did was actually not price the risk, but then took on all the risk as part of the alliance contract. So it's like the worst of both worlds. When you have a price competition, it's like a design and construct tender, but you actually can't measure and manage the risk and price the risk. But then the contract says that you're going to take on all the risk. So I was like, wow, we actually got through that one quite successfully, but only by the skin of our teeth. The greed of parties overriding principles. This is a slight concern to me when I look around and see that both parties are now starting to get greedy. And the principle is that, you know, is that's not what it's about. It's about best for project, which is, you know, it's an open book model, so the concept of greed shouldn't exist. But you can see it starting to creep in. You can see the mistrust starting to creep in as this occurs. And if we don't wake up to that, we'll see a great model start to fail. Finding enough people to do A teams. I mean, the A team was always the issue. Like, if you bring the A team, you'll get it. If you bring the B team, you won't get it. So the selection process is all about the right team to deliver this project. There's only so many A teams you can actually deliver as an industry. So eventually, some projects will fail because the A teams aren't there. Ensuring owners have enough right people. So you need the A team from the owner as well. And, you know, with owners having outsourced and cut down in size, it puts a lot of pressure on them to stump up the right people to even sit on the board level, let alone to be involved in the project delivery. So I think that's a challenge. Bid costs for these projects are significant, and from a consultant's point of view, not as good as design and construct, because we don't get paid for bidding these things, and that's just, I guess, our fault. But you know, again, the bid costs are significant and we've got to work out how that can be managed in a better outcome. And people are trying to get too smart in their commercial models. Spreadsheets are wonderful things, but by God, they can create some monsters in terms of commercial models. And when you're building alliancing around KPIs and performance KPIs and getting paid for these, I've seen some horribly complex things to the point where the people that create them can't even explain how they're supposed to work. And I just think, go back to the early ones where it was pretty damn simple and it delivered great outcomes, and we just don't need that level of complexity. You know, it's not about having complex commercial models, it's about having the right project outcomes. And just as a little example, you know, Barwon Water. Somewhere, someone, a friend of a friend came to me and said, oh, look, you know, we've got a client, Barwon Water, who's got a huge infrastructure delivery project, and, you know, just can we have a chat? So Mike Maloof came down and we had a bit of a chat, and he explained his problem where, you know, they delivered X million dollars of infrastructure for the last 20 years and suddenly they had 5X to deliver over the next 5 years, and what might be possible. So I said, well, you know, I just talked to him about the whole concept of alliancing and how it had affected us, and also how it had changed the culture inside Coffee. So it wasn't just about delivering projects. We'd actually brought that culture back into the organisation. And so when I was asked to give this talk, I said, oh, maybe we should go back and find out what happened. Well, sure enough, I mean, Mike had been through the concept of PPPs and couldn't get financing, and actually had developed an alliance which has really just come to market to deliver 80 projects worth over $300 million in the next 4 to 6 years. And just in asking, you know, so why did you go that way? It was really not only the commercial opportunity, you know, the fact that we probably weren't any other ways, but in terms of building the organisation and changing it, you know, the whole opportunity to actually bring IP back into the organisation, change the culture of the organisation, all the things that I talked about were sort of part of the decision making as to why to go down this path. And it's not a traditional big infrastructure project. That's the other reason I sort of mention it, because it's actually a lot of small projects. It's a total amount of $300 million over 5 years, so it's not a big spend. But I think it's a great example of how a relatively small group of projects can actually be packaged together into a program to still focus on what's best for project, what's best for the client, and it'll be really interesting to see, because some of the other projects that are being delivered by Barwon Water are the other forms of contract delivery. So it'd be interesting in 5 or 6 years' time to look back and say, you know, what worked, what didn't work. So just in conclusion, selection and procurement model needs to suit the project objectives and client capability. You know, it's not about one model's right, it's about horses for courses. Someone bears the cost of risk, and the day that we think that someone else is taking it, I mean, I think as an industry we've got to stop believing that shedding risk is a good thing, because someone ultimately pays for it. And I don't believe it's necessary. I think you can actually identify it, manage it, and deliver upon it. Active risk management is a better way than risk transference as a sustainable solution for the industry. Private risk equity has dried up due to GFC, but also some risk realisation on some projects. So we've seen Cross City Tunnel in Sydney, we've seen BrisConnects in Brisbane, and you know, they're commercially disastrous, obviously, for the players. So technically, they're all great projects. So we can sit here as engineers and say, yeah, look, that doesn't matter, you know, someone did their shirt. As an industry, I just think it's unacceptable. We do need a new source of funding with less risk and lower returns as a place in the market, I believe, if we're going to tap into the private funding. I think alliancing has proven to be an advanced form of delivery for complex projects that creates flexibility and value for all. And it's only from personal experience over 8 or 10 years that I can actually stand here and hand on heart say absolutely no qualms, but I know that's not true of all projects. So there are chinks in the armour, and we really need to address that before we see some major disappointments. The concept of trust and risk sharing is diametrically opposed. So the whole issue of shedding risk and trust, you know, it doesn't go hand in hand. So I think the whole, it's not surprising to me where those risk-shedding models have failed. So I'm a big fan of actually finding people you like working with, that you trust, and actually getting on and doing great work. And it kind of sounds simple, but, you know, fundamentally that's what an alliance contract formalises, and the delivery of them has been great. And I think we really need to reinvent, though, what's possible under an alliance form or some new form of contract delivery that basically shares the principles that alliances have been built on. So that's it in terms of the formal presentation, and feel free.